Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts recalled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled The Feminine Mystique, Writing Strong Female Protagonists. Ensuring a female protagonist's thoughts and actions remain true to the norms of bygone eras and cultures causes headaches for writers and readers. How does an author maintain immediacy if limited to second-hand observations of male-dominated history? Should women of the past be depicted with more power and influence than would have been afforded them? And how do you treat a young heroine in an age where girls were restricted and children expected to be seen and not heard? Sophie Masson examined how to portray plausible female protagonists with Juliette Marillier, Elizabeth Jane Corbett and Christy Murray.
Hello everyone, and today on this panel we're talking about the feminine mystique, which caused a little bit of hilarity when we were discussing it before, because of course that was the title of Betty Friedan's book about bored housewives, and we're not really going to be talking about bored housewives at all. So we're going to be talking about female protagonists, how we create female characters, whether there's a difference between writing male and female characters, how do you portray women and girls in eras where women and girls have not traditionally had political or social power. So we're going to look at a whole lot of different things, but what we're going to start with is something that's based very much in the writing process, but also about a particular novel, a particular character. And what I want to ask each of you is, in turn, to talk about, do you have a favourite female character you've created and why is she important to you? Kirsty?
Oh, that's such a terrible question. I'm glad the characters aren't in the room because they'd all feel betrayed if they named one over the other. My writing process involves being haunted by my characters to the point where they stand at the end of my bed and nag me to get up really early. So I guess the least nagging one, who's the one I love because she didn't have to nag me, was a character in The Year It All Ended, and her name's Martina Flynn, and she is actually quite closely based on my grandmother, who turned 17 on the 11th of November in 1918. And she died when I was 3 years old, but she had a slightly younger sister, who was my great aunt, who was a very gifted gossip. I wouldn't go so far as to say as a storyteller, but totally unreliable source, but a beautiful, colourful character. So the book's actually based on the younger sister, whose name was Agnes McNamara, but I've called her Tiny Flynn in the book. I don't know how long you want me to talk about. I could talk about her all day.
No, well, so did you find it difficult to create a character? Obviously, if your great aunt was a colourful, vivid character, that's a basis and inspiration. But how did you go about situating that character in what would have been her youth, in a period where women's the assumptions about women might have been quite different?
Well, I think it's to be honest, I think a lot of people who knew my great aunt would have thought she was a mouse. We called her Auntie Bit because she was so tiny, which is why I named the main character Tiny. She was about 4'11". She was probably considered a little bit of a drab sparrow in some ways, but she had a hilarious sense of humour. And in writing the book, she filled me with stories when I was a child. And as we approached the anniversary of World War I, I started thinking a lot about her and her sisters. The McNamara family, who are called the Flynn family in the book, there were five children. There was my great-uncle Louis, and then there were four younger sisters. And in 1914, Uncle Louis, August 1914, he signed up, he went to France, He was at Gallipoli first, but mostly served on the Western Front. And in September 1918, he wrote a letter home to his younger sisters and said, "I'll be home for Christmas." And they were so excited. They were thrilled that they were going to get him back. He was the hero of the family. You can tell where this is going. And one of the last engagements of World War One in the Somme, he died of injuries and was buried at Wood Courcelles, and they never saw him again. But they were expecting him. They were getting ready for Christmas. And when the minister came to the door to announce that he was never coming home, really the whole family fell apart. And I actually thought a lot as Uncle Louis was all over the internet all of a sudden. And they were reading his war record. And he was, you know, I can Google his name and there he is. And I had pictures of him as a kid, we all did. But I thought, well, what about all the people who didn't go to war? What about all the women who actually cleaned up the mess of all those broken lives? And there were so many war nurse stories coming out and women who'd been there. And I thought, what about the women who stayed here, who nursed the injured in their own homes, and nobody acknowledged them? And nobody told those really boring housewife stories. Because those four sisters, each, for me, illustrated a different experience of mid-20th century womanhood that I knew, because I knew their stories. But I'd never read them. I'd never read about those really ordinary lives. And my great-grandmother was German South Australian. In 1918, it was illegal to speak German in Adelaide, and there was a lot of shame about the fact that they were a very old Barossa family, but didn't really want to talk about that. So I researched what that must have meant for my great-grandmother too, and just thought about those really complex narratives. Feminine narratives are really complex because we haven't been accorded the voice, and there's not the documentation. So as a reader, I went to France, I went to Uncle Louis's grave, and I spent about a month in Adelaide, walking Adelaide and trying to imagine what those teenage girls were like who I only knew some of them as elderly women. But it really stunned me how the story always ends at 1918. That's it. It's over. And the story you tell is the story of the boys who either did or didn't come back. But the narrative arc of the women who then rebuilt the country and who dealt with that incredible tsunami of grief and all the intricacies, we just flip over 5 years and then, oh, you've got, you know, the jazz age, you've got the flappers and you've got the late 1920s. But nobody tends to look at that little window, which was pivotal in reinventing Australia. So, and it was those girls who reinvented it, and they were girls. They were really young women. So my Tina Flynn is sort of, and her sisters are my tribute to those women, the ones I knew and the ones I didn't.
Fantastic. Juliet, what about you?
Very, very hard to choose a favourite character. At any time when I'm asked, it's usually the protagonist of whatever I'm currently writing. But I thought, because I knew this question was coming, toss up between the protagonists of these two. This is the one that's just come out, new series, so I'm still writing about her because I'm writing the second book. Immediately previous series, which is the Blackthorne and Grimm series, I decided I would talk about Blackthorne rather than Levon. They're very closely related, but very different. My stories all have strong female protagonists, but they're not all the same. And it's interesting that something I've resisted doing over the course of 22 books was having a sort of a ballsy warrior, big and strong female character. They've usually solved their problems and met their challenges by what you might consider to be more traditionally female means. In fact, in the new series, I have a tall, broad-shouldered female warrior as the central character, so I've done it at last. And interestingly enough, she developed through this series, even though she's not in this series except as a twinkle in somebody's eye, I guess. So I want to talk about Blackthorne, who's the female protagonist of the Blackthorne and Grimm series. She came about because at some point I was challenged by a reader to write a series with an older character as the central person. In the past, I think because I write mostly early, very early medieval period, you know, people lived much shorter lives then. Many of the women died in childbirth or just as being worn down by what their lives were like in those days. A lot of the men died in nasty accidents or were cut down in war. People were having their children in their, you know, as soon as they were really old enough physically to produce them, so in their teens. And to put an older protagonist in as the central character, well, you know, how old did they get to be? Many of them would be dying before they were 30. By the time you were in your 30s, you'd be really getting on in years. Still, if you survive those years of having your children, if you survive those years of being out on the battlefield or, you know, nasty accidents on the farm or whatever, then you might live to be 50, 55 even. If you were lucky, you might become a wise elder of the tribe, which would make me a supremely wise elder of the tribe. Yeah, so Blackthorn and Grimm are both slightly older characters, and the other thing that goes into this book, apart from having an older and more mature protagonist, is that I had been reading a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder for various reasons, and particularly in the military. I'd read a couple of magnificent books about service of American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and the terrible amount of grief and baggage that they came home with and how that impacted on themselves, their whole families and the community. And of course, PTSD is not a 20th century, 21st century phenomenon. It's been around since it was called shell shock and it was called other things. And so back in these times, people also got messed up by the trauma that they'd experienced and it had an impact on the whole of their lives. How do they heal themselves? How do they put themselves together? Can they put themselves together? Well, at the start of this series, the Blackthorn and Grimm series, we meet the two characters, Blackthorn and Grimm, as they're in a really ghastly and hideous situation, having experienced a lot of very bad things in their lives. They're locked up together in a vile establishment where people are being tortured. And I guess the series, as well as being a series that's got a lot of magic in it, because, yes, I'm a fraud, I'm a historical fantasy writer, not a historical fiction writer, but you'll find that the two go together, so I do belong here. Yeah, we see them at absolute rock bottom at the start of this book, and it is a story through the three volumes of this series of they're gradually crawling towards the light of healing together, how they help each other, how they sort themselves out, how they sort out a lot of other people, because each of the books in this series is a standalone story. That's not her on the cover. That's a younger, more glamorous character who was someone not me chose to put on the cover. So I would quite like to have seen my 30-something protagonist on the cover. This will play out later on if we talk about tweaking history and tweaking the way things were to fit your story. I loved writing these books very much. I loved taking a character who had a weight of experience and who had almost lost hope, so the little flame of hope within was down almost to the stage of going out, and she's given a chance to make something of her life. Every one of my books is about confronting the challenges in your life and finding your inner strength and managing to move forward. And I think that, you know, people talk about the hero's journey, particularly when we're writing fantasy, and the hero's journey is something of a masculine journey, even though both male and female characters can undertake it. But I think rather than the going out and undertaking the external quest and coming back home and being rewarded for that, the hero's journey for a woman is often about diving within and finding your own strength and making something of your life and meeting your challenges by finding that, you know, that something within you that keeps you going. So that's Blackthorn. Fantastic. Clearly I love her very much, warts and all. Yeah, she wouldn't be an easy person to be with in real life, because I've made her really quite abrasive as the result of what's happened in her past. But she is She's been a healer in the past. It's hard to be a healer when you're despairing and out of hope. You can't reach out to other people, but somewhere within her, she's still got that quality that has enabled her to do that in the past. And of course, that comes back. Okay.
Fantastic. Thank you, Elizabeth Jane.
Well, it wasn't a hard decision for me because this is my debut novel. I don't have a lot to go on. And one of the reasons it was my debut novel was, and it happened late in life, was because I had always wanted to write a novel or multiple novels, but I just didn't have any ideas, or at least I thought I didn't have any ideas. And I thought if I was a real novelist, I would. They would have just dropped from the sky. And I reached a significant birthday and realised that if I was going to give it a go, I might have to try and kickstart the process. And I had always been fascinated by the character of Carolyn Chisholm, and so I began to just research immigration to Australia. And I think one of the reasons my protagonist, Bridie, will always be a favourite character is because I, who thought I had no ideas, all of a sudden this young woman came into my mind, and I knew she'd lost her father in really tragic circumstances. And she became alive to me. She didn't come out fully formed, and I did change her along the way, but the first time a character begins to speak and become alive, I think, I don't know if there's going to ever be any joy beyond that in life, and I'm experiencing it again, but she'll be my first one. I was also told very early on that I was a psychological writer, and I didn't actually know what that meant, so I had to go home and look it up. But my Bridie's journey is very much an internal journey. She's on an external journey. The whole book takes place on a ship between London and Port Phillip. But what I realised was that she had lost her father in tragic circumstances, and she was holding on to an untruth, some untruths about him, that she actually needed to face before she could become a woman. So it's very much about having the courage to face the truth, which I think we all have to do in various aspects of her life. So she was, in many ways, powerless. She was a child. She was on the cusp of womanhood. She was with a stepfather and a mother. She didn't have a lot of say in how things went. In fact, none of the migrants on the ship did. So it had to be a journey about coming to terms with something. And so that's the kind of strength. And I'm finding, even in my next book, that I am fascinated by that internal coming of strength.
And thinking on from that, I'd like to talk a bit about the difference between writing a female protagonist who's a woman and one who's a child. And you touched on that there because Bridie's powerless doubly because she's a child, because she's a girl. Do you see, how would you see, for instance, if you're writing only from the point of view of a girl who doesn't, you know, that the novel doesn't follow her development into womanhood, how would you characterise that development when you're setting it in a period which isn't ours, so therefore there's a lot less agency for girls, there's a lot less opportunities? So how would you characterise that double powerlessness of the child whilst at the same time, obviously, this character that you're writing about is going to be strong because she's at the core of a novel, so she's got to be. You don't write about wishy-washy characters. So how would you do that?
Well, for Bridie, she was strong in her grief, and she was strong in her anger, and she was strong in her hurt. So those things can make a character strong even when they're powerless. So, and some of her rebellions may not have been huge rebellions. They may have just been a tension or an argument or a decision to seek out the opinion of someone. But you can actually make those things into something. So she was strong in that she had false beliefs, but she believed them very strongly. And so therefore to actually change those beliefs, she had to be challenged very strongly too, and she had to put up a fight against that, and then she finally had to come to an understanding of that. And so I make it quite torturous for her, coming to terms with that. And with conflict on multiple levels. So she had conflict with her mother, conflict with her stepfather, and then conflict within herself. And then in my book, The Voyage, the journey is also almost like a character. And so the metaphor of going and arriving, she's... There wasn't a woman in Port Phillip in my era, so the legend goes, over the age of 16 years of age, who wasn't married. Mm-hmm. And she was 15. And she realises very early in the book that when she gets to Port Phillip, she's going to have to get married. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the race against time for her growing up, because hopefully what the reader realised was this girl's not ready. She's mm-hmm. not ready, and yet she's facing this, and she doesn't want it. And how is she going to become someone who is ready for the challenges of that new land? So I don't think it has to be explosive action, and I don't think it even has to be huge gestures, as long as you can show tension and conflict on multiple levels.
Okay. Juliet, in your books where you have child characters, young girls, so how would you deal with that, characterise them?
Probably the only time I've really had a character who grew from a young girl through to an adult as the protagonist of the novel would be Daughter of the Forest, which was my very first book. Mostly they're entering what would be considered adulthood in their time. So hard to go back to that one. It's a long time ago. I think instead of talking about her, I'll talk about child characters in the more recent books, because I do have a couple of young girls, particularly in The Harp of Kings, which is the most recent book. There's a young girl called Ashlyn who is absolutely necessary to the story in terms of providing information to the main character. I guess it's really needing to balance the fact that we as the reader can see that society or that group as a whole, and we can see what limitations there are on this child. This is a child who's actually being abused by someone in a position of power and who is frightened, but she's also of royal blood and is supposed to behave in a certain way, and she escapes and confides in Levon, who's the central character of the story. And it's an interesting relationship in that Levon is the, you know, the tall, strong, ballsy warrior that we've mentioned, but in this case she's a spy, and so she's masquerading as a musician because she has talents as a musician. She's very handy to put her in the court to spy, because she can just pretend to be the girl in the band. And she has to move outside her normal persona. She'd like to be out there. She'd like to be out there fighting, climbing trees, doing all sorts of physical stuff. Has had no experience with children, and she's confided in by this very vulnerable child who she happens to meet when they're both hiding up in a tree. And she has to, therefore, Levon has to find that more compassionate listening part of her own persona, which is difficult, and the child has obviously seen in her someone whom she can trust, because she's heard the music, and the music is beautiful, and she's seen this beautiful woman, you know, in her dress playing in front of the audience. So in a sense, that I guess that scene doesn't really necessarily need the historical context. It could happen anywhere, because it's a case of a child who's vulnerable finding someone that she can, you know, that she can finally unburden herself to. I don't think I'm answering your question. I think I'm answering other sort of question. It would be very difficult to write that from the child's point of view, which I don't, because it's always Levon's, in her chapters, it's always her first-person point of view. So she's hearing the child's story and trying to interpret what she hears. If you're in the child's point of view, you're very limited in what you can say, because you've got to be right inside that seven-year-old's head and just have her perceptions of the world beyond, the world through your eyes. Might be a very, very narrow place, even though you're in the King's Court and all sorts of stuff is happening around you. As a writer, the way to do that is to get to know a few seven-year-olds and find out what makes them tick. And I have to say, I'm better at doing it now than I was way back when. I can remember one child character in an earlier book who was very good at storytelling and extremely fluent and my editor, who had a child the same age, said, you know, no seven-year-old kid ever talks like that. No, I thought he did because he was destined to be a druid when he grew up. But now I have not only had four children, but I have eight grandchildren, some of whom are around the sort of seven, eight, nine age group. So I have a lot more to go by, and I hope she's more realistic as a result.
Mm. Great. Kirsty.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, because what is a child, really? And certainly when you look at the girl child in history, you're a woman at 12 in some areas. Like by in the early 19th century, you're looking at 12-year-old brides. So when is a child a child? And in terms of child characters, I don't really like to write characters under 11 because I think they have no agency, as Juliet said. It's very difficult with characters, very young characters, to give them any agency in the story. But I think when a child is on the cusp of that philosophical stage, they're really interesting to write about. And I wrote another favourite character was a character called Bridie O'Connor, who's one of the orphan girls. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Earl Grey famine orphans. In the late 1840s, Earl Grey arranged for 4,500 Irish orphan girls taken out of the workhouses of Ireland to be shipped to Australia to create a working class of young females as potential brides for convicts. The girls were between the ages of 9 and 16. They were traumatised. They lived through an incredible apocalyptic time. Not all of them were orphans. Some of them were leaving their parents behind. They clamoured to get onto the ships, 250 girls at a time. And they were sent to Sydney, Melbourne, Moreton Bay and Adelaide. The Adelaide girls wound up as being the backbone of the prostitution trade. They had a terrible time, and we treated them really badly as a nation. Well, we weren't a nation then, but one of the famous comments I came across when I was researching them was, it was around the same time as John Howard was saying some interesting comments about immigration, and they said about the Irish girls, these are not the sort of people we want in this country. And I'm sure there's some of their descendants sitting in here now. So they were, but they were little girls. I mean, 9 to 16. But in that era, they were brought out to be apprenticed till they were 19. In terms of how they operated in the world, they were working women. So I think the whole notion of a child in historical fiction, you have to go quite young to actually have them manifest as a true child as we understand a child now. So the orphan girls of the late 1840s and early 1850s, I fictionalised one of them. I called her Bridie O'Connor and based her story on multiple experiences of girls of that period. And really they were hard-working, adventurous, young adults at quite an early age. So it's the semantics of what is a child that intrigues me in that question.
Yeah, well, I guess it's because despite that, they still had very little power, even less than grown women. You just have to think to even children who were in positions of power, like for instance in royal families and stuff, that they were manipulated, they were, and it was only when they got to a certain age that they could actually take power on their own. So, you know, you still had the situation where the youth of someone told against them in historical terms.
I'd say working-class girls actually had more agency than affluent girls because those girls, lots of them ran away, went to the gold fields, took control of their own lives, broke their apprenticeships.
Yeah.
And I actually discovered them through reading the records of the Royal Melbourne Hospital, because I was really stuck finding any girl characters for a turn-of-the-century novel that I was working on. And there was nothing about working-class girls. And in desperation, I read this history of the Royal Women's Hospital and found this amazing graph where it was showing deaths, maternal deaths through the 19th century, and it went diggle, 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 and it went ping, and then it went diggle, 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 like this. And I thought, what is that? Why is there, you know, even in a graph there's a great story. And the footnote was these were the Earl Grey famine orphans who'd come of age and were giving birth, and their pelvises were malformed from malnutrition. So they couldn't birth these great big Australian babies. And they died. And that's how I tracked the story back, was through that one fact. And that was where reading that... reading, it was Janet McCalman's History of the Royal Women's Hospital, and reading that book, I got learned so much about the feminine mystique, which was, nobody was bored in that book, they were working really hard, but the history of the hospital revealed so much of the truth of women's lives that I couldn't find elsewhere.
Yeah, and that brings me to the next question, actually, very nicely, about how you find the sources for your creation of convincing female characters in a convincing recreation of a historical period. So you've said, Kirsty, that you know, you had a lot of trouble finding sources for these girls until you went to, you know, a source that you might not have realised initially would be full of great stuff. So how do you go about it when you're looking at those lives? What do you have to do to piece together the background research?
You want to go first? Okay. You could get me on a roll with this. I can tell you about all my favourite ferreting tricks. But,
So with The Tides Between, I read a number of diaries about, and some of those were written, most of those were actually written by people who could read and write, so it wasn't always the people in steerage, but sometimes they had reflections of them, on the people in steerage. But it was a quite well-documented government immigration scheme. So there were statistics on how many girls came out. Then you can read things like the instructions for surgeons on immigrant vessels. They're available online. And so then it was simply a matter of imagining these girls. They either came out in... There were the single girls at one end of the ship... the single men at the other, and the families in between, and there were often no petitions. So once you have those sorts of ideas in your mind, you can begin to just get people to board the ship and see how they interact. So there's a great deal of information, but it's very statistical information, and then you have to, I suppose, grasp it by the horns and think, okay, so what was it like for my girl, and that, I think that's the problem for any novelist, whether they're writing now or in the past. There's a point at which you have to say, "I've immersed myself in this situation. I know what they ate. I know their schedule. I know how they were housed. I know how the voyage went. Now she's going to board the ship, and we're going to see what happens." And the other aspect of my book, I suppose, which I haven't mentioned and I always forget to mention, is that there are a pair of storytellers on the ship. The stories mirror and also inform the voyage, and the storytellers become part of Bridie's journey. And so I did a great deal of research on Welsh mythology and storytelling as well for that. And because I enjoyed that so much, it really informed the plot, and I think probably what made the difference for the book. And having said that, her subversive act was simply that she wanted to be able to hang on to her dad's stories, and her mother was saying to grow up she had to let them go. So it doesn't have to be a big act. And then you just draw it all in.
My period is quite early. It's Ireland in the early medieval time, so we're earlier than the Anglo-Normans in Ireland, but we're after the Norse raids on the coast, and we're after the Celtic Christians have arrived. So it's an interesting period. Ireland still has is a patchwork of small kingdoms. There is a high king, and there are also kings and chieftains elsewhere. So, you know, little wars breaking out, little power struggles. And another interesting thing about Ireland in that period is that the legal system was remarkably fair, considering what kinds of systems were in place in many parts of the world at that time. Breton law was there prior to the Anglo-Normans, and it's quite amazingly fair. Well, not amazingly, but for the period, it's fair to women in many ways. It still doesn't stop you from having to, you know, birth children until you're very unwell. But there are provisions for getting out of a toxic marriage in Brehon law. There are all sorts of grounds on which a woman can divorce her husband, including failing to satisfy her in bed, which I think is very interesting. And so while there's not a whole lot of documentation left, there's enough documentation to let us know that it's relatively fertile ground for a story with a strong female protagonist, because there were protections there. There were women in some positions of power. I had to make decisions in my story about whether I was going to be in the Christian communities or in communities that still followed the earth-based religions prior to Christianity. I've got druids in this series. It was interesting hearing someone else talking about druids on a panel this morning, because I'm both someone who researches historical druidry and I'm also a present-day druid myself. So I was about to, you know, I would have leapt up and asked curly questions this morning, but that wasn't for me. So, so I've built that religious system in here as well. So I've got the advantage of the legal system suggesting that it's a society that's fairer to women. But I wanted to have a female warrior in this story. We're sort of almost edging into that period of how much freedom do you have as a fantasy writer as opposed to a writer of historical fiction. The answer is not as much as you would think, because as a fantasy writer who's setting the book in a time and place in real history, I, like these people, have to make sure that everything is consistent with the period, that everything is possible within the period. So the stuff like the details of the daily lives and who really did have authority and all of that, it's got to be accurate. You can't just say, right, I'm a fantasy writer, I'm going to put anything in it that I like, I'll have them eating, you know, vegetables from Asia or whatever I want. The nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts of the story have to work for the historical period, I think, anyway. Not every writer's going to be the same. But, of course, there's also a mythological or an uncanny or magical element in the book, or it wouldn't be fantasy. So I not only have to research the history, I have to research the mythology as well, because if I'm setting a book in that period, I would like the uncanny elements to fit with what people in that day and age might have believed in. Well, sort of set aside the question of how much of it might or might not have been real or unreal, what might they have believed in? And then in my stories, the mythological or the uncanny elements are actually in the story as well. So technically it should make sense. The warrior girl, woman, who's in the centre of this story, I don't have anything in real history that's going to say that there were female warriors at that particular place at that time, but I do have a whole lot of examples from Irish mythology of warrior women, including, you know, the great hero Cuchulainn, who is in all the Irish myths, was trained by Scortha, who was a warrior woman who lived on an island and, you know, was an elite warrior and taught him. And so there's an island in my book, not with a mythological figure on it, but with a community of people who teach superior fighting skills and spying and how to get in and out of tight places and so forth. And Levorn, my heroine, starts the story in training to become one of this elite warrior band. So I feel that it's kind of justified by the information that's available, whether it's not necessarily, you know, strictly historical records.
Great, thank you. Do you have anything to add, Kirsty? We'll need to wrap up soon so we can ask questions.
Well, I think one of the things in researching women is it's really important to think laterally and to be innovative in your research techniques. And I am a big fan of reading newspapers if it's a period where there actually are newspapers, particularly reading the women's columns. When I wrote this particular book, India Dark, it's set in 1909 and it's based on a true story about 29 children, mostly girls. There were 7 boys in the troop, but they sailed from Melbourne to Calcutta via Southeast Asia, singing and dancing. They were called Pollard's Lilliputian Opera Company. They were a real opera company. The girls left no record, but I read Court Records. Court Records are fantastic, actually, for finding girls in trouble, and they're pretty hilarious too. Archives, because the paper trail for girls is much more fraught than the paper trail for boys. So reconstructing the girls in this particular book was a fabulous journey because I really honed those skills of looking beneath the surface of a story and looking for how girls move through the world, which is fairly secretly. So looking at archival material, which can be manuscripts, which can be unpublished memoir, can every state library holds those sort of papers, and they're not obvious. Talking to specialists in the area with that one, I interviewed a lot of theatre historians, and really, historians are just gossips with degrees. They're really good if you can get them on track. So, yeah, thinking laterally is the best way to unearth most intriguing information about how girls lived in earlier periods.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.